It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you for joining me. I'm going to start off today's show talking about a recent New York Times article, but the bulk of the show, I'm going to talk about the miracle recovery of the Klamath River with the removal of a dam and what's happened over the 420-mile stretch. Talk about West Nile disease and some interesting research. And then as we move into summer, how we think about our hunting dogs, in particular, but dogs in general and what they need. But starting off, the New York Times on Tuesday published an article that I think makes you wonder, is indeed the New York Times fair in some of the reporting, and is it coordinated politically? And I say that with trepidation because I do have respect, obviously, for America's journalism. It's what we need to have for a free society and free press. The headline is, he built an airstrip on protected land. Now he's in line to lead the U.S. Forest Service. So this headline appeared on Tuesday, the same day that Mr. Michael Boren is to be nominated before the Senate Agricultural Committee to be the Undersecretary of Agriculture for Natural Resources and the Environment, which oversees the Forest Service. This announcement was made back in January that Mike Boren from Idaho was going to be the undersecretary nominee for Undersecretary of Agriculture and Resources, Natural Resources and the Environment. And yet, the New York Times wrote, as far as I know, nothing about it for 6 months, and then on the day of his confirmation hearing, they dropped the article, which is a complete hit piece on Michael Boren. And I think it's totally unfair. I think it's lousy journalism. And I think it does confirm, whether you want to or not, that maybe our media is not unbiased and our newspapers aren't unbiased in how they cover things. They could have written this article at any time, but they wrote it and published it just hours before he was appeared before the Senate committee. Happens to be that I know Mike Boren. Happens to be that I like Mike Boren, and I respect him enormously and what he has done for the betterment of America and for Idaho and for our natural resources goes completely unstated in the article, or the hit piece, as I call it, that the New York Times wrote on. Even if you didn't want to debate or discredit the charges the New York Times made that they reported on, you still would comment, well, what about the belief that there are two sides to every story, or there certainly has to be more to Mike Boren's background than what's alluded to in the article, because the article would have you think he's would be the single worst undersecretary of agriculture we've ever had. He knows nothing. In fact, the article says he knows nothing about the Forest Service, or words to that effect. And it says he's clashed with the Forest Service for years. He has no background. Well, I have to tell you, that's completely wrong. And it's not that I'm picking on the New York Times. Whoever would have written such a piece, I would have challenged. And it's not that I'm challenging him on hearsay. It's challenging them based upon firsthand knowledge of an individual who I consider to be an exceptional nominee to be Undersecretary of Agriculture. And it's also stating, reaffirms, why would anyone want to be a public servant if you have to go through this kind of stuff, this kind of garbage, to serve your country? So I'm not going to sit here and go line by line through what the New York Times wrote, because that's not really what I'm trying to do here. What I'm trying to say is it's unfair that anyone would write such an article without balancing it out with other opinions. I can tell you that Mike Boren is absolutely qualified to be Undersecretary of Natural Resources and the Environment. He has spent much of his life in the outdoors in Idaho. He knows our natural forests intimately and how they work. He owns land that is checkerboarded with Forest Service properties. Nowhere in the article does it talk about that he has flown I don't know how many backcountry missions on behalf of the Forest Service, search and rescue missions to find lost hikers, lost skiers, has dropped in people to help fight fires. He has worked hand in glove with the Forest Service. He has worked closely with them on all kinds of emergency coverage. And when fires have broken out in the American West and in Idaho, Mike Bourne has taken his own time and his own resources and volunteers with others to help the Forest Service. None of that's reported in the article. None of it's talking about how his grazing practices on the properties in which he's engaged are exemplary modern day grazing practices for a sustainable landscape. You don't read any of that. You don't read the fact that Mike Bourne happens to love to hunt, love to fish, has been engaged in philanthropy in Idaho and across America with efforts that are trying to improve our natural resources and conservation. All of that is missed because it's not relevant to what was written about him in the New York Times. Instead, the New York Times, which I have to believe was set up by an environmental group to write this article. I'll be surprised if I'm wrong. I doubt the author's ever been to Idaho, certainly hasn't been to see Bourne's work, and certainly didn't talk with anyone at the Forest Service or anyone in Idaho about all the good things that he's done, which are a lot. What they have is a nominee who's immensely capable. By the way, he cut his teeth at the Board of Trade in Chicago, so he has Midwestern connections. He is the kind of nominee that the environmental radical groups positively fear, an individual who actually is knowledgeable about the issues, an individual who cannot be bought or bribed. He's successful in his own right, and an individual who does not have a partisan bent, but he has an ideological belief that our forests should be well managed, that they should be healthy, they should be sustained, and that the forest fires that we've been dealing with and are going to continue to deal with need to be brought under control. To many segments of the environmental movement, that is not what they want to hear. And it's certainly not who they want to have in control of overseeing the Forest Service. They want more of the practices which have led us to this point, lock the gate, throw away the key. So it's unfortunate that an article like this, I don't care who the individual is written about, that is written about this with a bias. It's really, in my view, and I'm sure I'm going to get a call from journalists, perhaps, maybe they'll agree with me, it's not fair journalism. It's not good journalism to only present one side of a story. And if you read this article, you would think, oh my goodness, this is just an example of a terrible individual who's going to ruin our Forest Service. Cut every tree we have down. There'll be nothing left. Nothing could be further from the truth. So I took the time this morning, not because I know Mike Bourne. I took the time this morning to talk about this because I think it's wholly unfair on an individual who is dedicating his life to trying to make our country a better place, who has the skill sets, and the story of that, which will come out in his Senate confirmation hearings, is not told by one of the leading media outlets in America, because either they didn't choose to tell it, they didn't want to tell it, but the reporter, if they had done any digging at all, would have found out this is a highly respected individual, Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. He's an individual that's going to make the Forest Service and the natural resources of America better. I certainly expect him to be confirmed by the Senate. I hope he is. And when he is, we'll find out in a couple of years that he will have been the very best undersecretaries ever with overseeing the Forest Service because of his passion and because of his knowledge, which the article said he didn't have any knowledge. I can firsthand tell you, he has a lot of knowledge, and the chief of the Forest Service would never have taken the job knowing that Mike Bourne was going to be nominated if he didn't think Mike Bourne was an exceptionally qualified individual for the job as well. So sometimes I have to comment, in this case, the New York Times, I just think was way out of line, and they wouldn't publish an op-ed for me, I'm sure, on this and other things, but that's my feelings, and I think we'll look back in time and say this was a great selection. I'll be back in just a moment with more on the great outdoors, and when I do, I'm going to talk about the Klamath River and what's happening there, and which is wonderful. This is the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. First, a message from our Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And going to move on here to talk about the Klamath River, which is phenomenal. The removal of the dams that happened a little over a year ago. And the story, and it's a story that we've seen play out many times across the Midwest, when tiles have been broken, how quickly the marsh comes back. It's a story of, in the case of the Klamath River Basin, when we really we took down dams that have been in place for years, decades, and we removed them, and within an incredibly short period of time, areas that have been underwater in a reservoir for 70 years have sprung back to life. Fish have moved up the Klamath River almost immediately when the dam went out and the water cleared and the water went down. Fish that had not been able to move beyond the dam for over 70 years suddenly began to move upstream and populate habitat. So within a year of the dams being removed, we've got an over 200-mile stretch of the Klamath River in Oregon that is now flowing free, flowing clear. It's absolutely phenomenal. So it goes to show that if we give nature just a little bit of a chance, it can recover. And this, the removal of the Klamath River dams, there'll be more to come on this after we get through this summer. But the pictures that are being taken of the habitat are just incredible of how quickly it's recovered. I think that the most hopeful, optimistic of scientists and natural resource managers felt the river could recover and would recover. There are very few people that could have anticipated it would have happened this quickly. It's a huge success story. There's lots of discussion about removal of obsolete dams in the American West. What's happened on the Klamath River is demonstrating that probably worth having those discussions. It's a real win. West Nile virus. We've talked about it a number of times on the air over the years. Now there's some serious science being done. And mosquitoes, as you may recall, are the transmitter of West Nile. West Nile has absolutely hammered bird populations. It began almost 20 years ago, started to see big die-offs in lots of birds, crows, ravens. It got into the waterfowl population, and it's worked its way through that. The birds that survived have some immunity to it. It is transmitted to humans, and it's a really, really bad it's a really bad situation that we are beginning finally to get some great science on. So we don't know precisely how West Nile is transmitted to pets and to humans through the bite. We know it comes from mosquito bites. The federal government has a project that has been working to pin down the process using mathematical models to analyze the factors like temperature, light pollution, and bird and mosquito abundance in areas where West Nile breaks out. The ultimate goal is very clear, to be able to come up with a way to minimize the transmission of West Nile disease, not only to animals, but to humans. And some of you listening may have gotten West Nile disease. It is very, very seldom fatal, less than 1% of the population, I think, would ever have that happen. And the belief is that there's other causes, if that happens, there are other causes that have led to that. I have known individuals who become completely debilitated through West Nile. Great friend of mine, you've heard, he was passed away, Buddy Melgus, the best sailor maybe ever to sail the waters of the world. He got West Nile, and for 2 years, he could hardly do the things that he had done all of his life. It was so sad to watch its impacts on him, his love of sailing, his love of hunting and the outdoors, and he was tired all the time. Time and again, this is being reported from West Nile. So what the project is trying to do is to say, how do we minimize it? When is West Nile most likely to be transmitted? And during that time, how do we best control it? So the hope really is that we're going to figure out when and how humans get affected. Right now, according to the early study, we know that humans tend to get infected in the late summer and early fall. And we know that birds are infected before then, but we don't really know where West Nile goes in the winter. So in order to be able to control it, we've got to understand the mosquitoes who transmit it. But research is underway, and for any of you who've had West Nile, I don't need to say any more. You know how debilitating it can be. And we just need to be vigilant and hope that we get some answers soon, because West Nile is continuing to expand. Lastly, dogs in summer. A lot of you love your dogs. A lot of you listening have wonderful hunting dogs, whatever their species might be, Labradors, Pointers, Setters, Spaniels, doesn't matter. Summer's a tough time on a dog, and we need to really recognize we might like the heat, they hate the heat. Dogs do not do well in the heat. I, unfortunately, when I was a kid, we lost one of our Labrador retrievers at our farm. It had been placed on a leash, and it couldn't get in the shade. It didn't have water. And 5 hours later, the dog was dead. You cannot provide enough water for your dogs in the summer. You cannot provide enough shade. Don't expose them to hot temperatures. Exercise them early in the morning, exercise them late in the evening, once the heat of the day is before it comes or after it leaves. But they're our best friends, they're our best companions, and the summer is a hard time on them. And they also, like us, they need exercise. So you need to get them out, but they need to go out at times when it's not going to be stressful on them. And most importantly, they need lots of water. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next Sunday morning with much more of The Great Outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.